Hello, it's Scott Manley here. It's July 29th. SpaceX is currently putting the ship into Starship in the Indian Ocean. It's time for another batch of deep space updates. And of course, we start with all the launches. There have been two Starlink launches in the last couple of weeks, on 21st of July and the 25th of July, both from Vandenberg. The first one was interesting because they actually lit the engines and then shut them down straight afterwards. And that was the third time we've seen an on-pad abort after the engines lit in the last month between Rocket Lab, SpaceX's Starship, and a Falcon 9. Anyway, moving on to the rest of the launches. On 16th of July, there was a Falcon 9 out of Vandenberg launching 21 satellites for the Space Development Agency into polar orbit. And this is the Transport Layer Tranche 1, the third launch. And what's kind of interesting is the previous two launches from this program were in September and October of 2025. But after they launched, there was some like on-orbit testing issues. They paused it to come up with some fixes. And now they have resumed the development and launch of this constellation, which, as I understand it, is primarily about laser interlinks between satellites to provide a rapid way to send data around the world that doesn't require cables and anything. On 18th of July in India, we had the Vikram 1 launching from Satish Dhawan. This was the debut orbital launch from Skyroot Aerospace, a company founded 8 years ago to be essentially India's version of SpaceX, right? Your private launch provider. They have launched only once previously. That was a suborbital sounding rocket. This one is much larger. It is a 4-stage, 3-solid, 1-liquid orbital launch vehicle. It carried actual payloads and it made it all the way to orbit on its first try. So congratulations for that. There was a bit of a hairy moment between the separation of the third and the fourth stage, which looked like something might have been sticking around longer than it should have. But ultimately, yeah, it made it to orbit. So congratulations to Skyroot. You know, many more launches. I hope you have luck going forwards. On the 19th of July in Russia, we had a Soyuz 2.1B launching out of Plesetsk, carrying the 16 Rosvit spacecraft from Bureau 1440 into sun-synchronous orbit. These are communication spacecraft, believed to be somewhat similar to Starlink, but obviously launching at a little lower cadence. 21st of July, we had a Falcon 9 launching from Slick 40, and this was a very special mission because this was an expendable launch. So the booster 1069 was expended. This was its 32nd flight, I believe, because it was carrying this payload off to geostationary orbit. It was carrying Northrop Grumman's mission robotic vehicle, which is carrying a bunch of robotic servicing payloads. The idea is this goes up to geostationary orbit and it's going to rendezvous with a target and basically service it. And the way it does this is it has three of these like mission extension pods. So its robot arms will pull one of these things out and you latch that onto the back of the old spacecraft, and that will then take over attitude control. It will take over station keeping. And the idea, this is more efficient than the previous mission that flew, which had to have this entire spacecraft had to hang around while it was hosting. This, in this case, they can drop off one of these mission extension pods and then move to the next satellite. So they're, you know, they're basically getting more bang for their buck. So we understand that two of the MEPs are already spoken for. There's an IntelSat spacecraft and an Optus D3. So MRV will rendezvous with both of those and then resurrect them. But yes, as I said, this mission, we expended booster 1069. It was kind of, you know, weird to see this launch with the legs missing and no grid fins, but you know, they all have to end sometime. 22nd of July in China, we had Gravity 1 from Orion Space. It was launching from a platform in the Yellow Sea, and it carried 9 payloads, right? So there was like 6 Dongpo satellites for the Huantian constellation, and there's a couple of optical satellites as well, and hyperspectral imaging, you know, other things like that. So a bunch of payloads, one of these things that launched from a solid, from a barge in the Yellow Sea. 23rd of July, we had a Long March 3B/E out of Qichang launching the Tianlan 2 spacecraft into geostationary orbit, and they confirmed that this satellite successfully reached its target orbit. They did not confirm or they did not comment on the fact that the rocket was hit by lightning on the way up. Now, I made a whole video about why rockets have a tendency to actually induce lightning. It does not appear to have affected this flight, but you know, it's obviously considered risky to have millions of volts zapping through your rocket as it's trying to fly, it's, you know, on the way to Spain. 23rd of July, also in China, we had Kinetica 1 launching from Jiuquan with five satellites on board. These all seem to be like small satellites. We have the Space Computing Satellite for Beijing Orbital Shenzhen Technology. There was a Commercial Space Debris Monitoring Satellite and High Resolution Infrared Intelligent Remote Sensing, because everybody's putting more compute on top of their satellites. And then on the 24th of July, we had Starship Flight 13. It was actually the second attempt, actually really the third, but you waved off one early on. I'll talk more about that in a minute because we should probably just clear out the launches. 29th of July, we also just had a Long March 7A carrying a Tianlan satellite again. Tianlan, by the way, is China's equivalent of NASA's TDRS constellation. These are data relay satellites that sit up in geostationary orbit, and then they can receive data from any satellite in low Earth orbit and relay it back to China. So this is very important if you've got a space station, for example, which is frequently beyond communications range with any ground station. You instead communicate with satellites up in space. So yes, many of you follow me for my space news updates. I like to go into the technical details that are, you know, glossed over by many mainstream news sources. But also, depending upon your mainstream news source, you might see entirely different conclusions based upon what they've covered or what they choose not to cover. This video is sponsored by Ground News. Ground News gathers related articles from around the world in one place with context about the source's political leanings, reliability, and ownership, so you can compare coverage and quickly understand the bigger picture. I like Ground News because they take the scientific techniques I learned to understand the universe and apply it to news outlets. The founder is in fact a former NASA engineer, and their tools help cut through the noise on the stories to help you find where the true story lays. One feature I use regularly is the blind spot feed. It flags stories that one side of the political spectrum is disproportionately covering or quietly ignoring, which is useful when you're trying to see what's actually driving the conversation versus what's being left out. Take the coverage of Starship's Flight 13 earlier this week. On Ground News, that story is covered by well over 100 sources. Looking at the headlines side by side, however, shows the split clearly. Some outlets emphasize the hard booster splashdown and call it another partial success, while others highlight the ship's intact recovery. It's the same flight, but with different language, and that language changes whether the test looks like progress or a setback. In the same news view, you can check factuality ratings and ownership details. That tells you how reliable the outlet's reporting practices have been historically, and whether you're reading something from an independent publisher, a media conglomerate, or a source with a particular financial interest. Ground News gives you the tools to see the bigger picture for yourself. Subscribe to get 40% off the Vantage plan by scanning the QR code on screen or by going to ground.news/manly. And yes, even although it's called Ground News, they also cover space news. And now, back to the video. Starship, oh my, we'd been waiting for this. And the first opportunity was, I think it was on the 16th. And we all watched this, we got excited. And I was sort of, I'm going to admit that I was sort of like wondering whether this thing would get away, because I actually had an open source event, right? Because open source weekend was that weekend. And I was expected to be at an event in the evening. And if Starship had launched, I would have had to have like knocked out a video really fast before going to this event. And I don't know if I had it in me. But regardless, yes, we counted down through the counting. It reached zero and the engines lit up, and four of them did not light up. So the launch was aborted. But apparently it came really close. In fact, I think that, well, the funniest comment I think on the subject came from Kate Tice, who said, "Yep. First V3 full stack static fire complete." No, I mean, I understand that, you know, there was a bit of drama. They had to de-stack things. They swapped out some of the engines. And the week later, they came back to launch again. And they confirmed that what had happened was they believed that there was ice, like water ice, inside the engines. And that is potentially a big problem here, right? Because ice, when at cryogenic temperatures, becomes very, very solid, and it can jam all sorts of things like valves, which need to be able to move very quickly during ignition. So anyway, those things have been swapped out. On the Friday, they successfully launched, and it was a very exciting mission, right? So first of all, we had a great ascent. We had all the new cameras. We saw fantastic stage separation. The booster flipped in the correct direction. They had a more conservative engine ignition sequence this time. that didn't allow anything to like knock the thing off central, because those engines in the upper stage that are igniting, they are going to push that lower, the booster around, and so they need to make sure that operates correctly. The booster, it performed like a proper flip back, boost back. It obviously shut engines down early so it wouldn't get all the way home. And then during landing, it had a problem igniting all the engines, so it smashed into the water at about 100 miles an hour, probably, based upon the telemetry that we did get during the last few seconds. Now, NASA spaceflight did actually get a few frames. If you like adjust the contrast, you can actually see the booster coming down and hitting the water. But yeah, that was not a great result. But the Starship, it continued onwards to orbit. It successfully got there, no problems. It began deploying its Starlink soon after dark. So they got out, we got to see some illumination on the side of the Starship. It successfully performed an engine relight. This would be the longest in-flight space firing off a Raptor in orbit that they've seen so far. I think it was like 14 seconds. So that doesn't really change the orbit much, because I think it was like firing perpendicular to the orbit. And then it performed a successful re-entry. And of course, it landed almost exactly on target. Again, we had multiple buoys on the ground looking at it. We had the drone hovering and watching this thing. And in some of those angles that we get from it coming down, that rocket exhaust comes really close to that drone. That is a very brave little robot facing off the massive dragon, Sea Dragon, right? Because it is now a Sea Dragon. After it landed, it fell over very gently. And I think one of the reasons, now that we've actually got, SpaceX have actually published some of the video, what we can see is as it comes down right at the end, it does this sort of sweep forwards. And it's almost like, if you imagine the engines firing down, it's like it's digging a trench in the water, stirring it up. And if you put foam, right, if you put gas into the water, it actually lowers its density and reduces its viscosity, which means that the thing may have actually made the water softer, which might explain why the stage fell over in the water and did not explode, as it is usually expected to do. Now, about a week later, we've seen photos from the crews on site. Elon Musk has said, yes, we're going to try and tow this home. And it's still floating after a week, so I'm getting hopeful, right? All the same, you know, some rough seas could actually break this thing up. It's not really designed for the ocean. It's designed for loads along one axis rather than the bending axis. So it could still suffer a failure on its way back. Regardless, I want it to come back. But also, Elon has confirmed that, you know, if there's nothing that turns up in the data that suggests a problem, they're probably going to go for a Starship tower catch on the next flight. That will mean that the Starship launch will move back to earlier in the day. I'm hoping it's not super early, because I don't like getting up at like 3 a.m. to watch a rocket launch. But if they launch earlier in the day, then, you know, that will allow Boca Chica to rotate around and be in the right place so they can actually land it. But we don't know the details. We will find out the details when we get closer to the launch, which could be in August, which is, you know, days away now. Okay, the other thing that happened, I guess it was kind of important, was that Soyuz MS-28 came home with its crew, Sergei Kucherkov, Sergei Mikhayev, and NASA's Christopher Williams. So it launched on 27th of November last year, and it landed on the 26th of July. So that's 240 days in space. Russia have moved Soyuz to like an 8-month crew rotation. That saves them a bit of money. You know, they're pushing the limits on what Soyuz can do, because of course they have peroxide and it has a tendency to disassemble, right? that's finally back on the Earth. So of course, Soyuz MS-29 has spent the last week in space hanging out together. We have a nice picture from Anil off the departing Soyuz spacecraft saying goodbye. Japan had posted video of their RVX test vehicle. This is actually a collaboration between JAXA, Kness, and the DLR, you know, the German, so France and Germany. And it's a bit like a Starhopper test vehicle. It's a, you know, it's only like a 24 feet, you know, 7 meter tall test vehicle with a single engine. It basically goes up, it comes back down. And their plans are to fly this higher and further and push the limits and get to understand reusability. And maybe one day this will lead them closer to being able to actually reuse their launch vehicles. Okay, so now last month, Chinese rocket launched Shijian 31, and it's now doing something which we've never seen before. Now, it was launched in an orbit which carried it up towards geostationary orbit, and we normally would have expected it to circularize that orbit, but after a month here, people have another theory. It's in a Molniya-like orbit, which basically takes it up over geostationary orbit, where it spends a lot of time just sitting up there as geostationary satellites fly underneath it. So it looks like this is a setup to basically observe satellites in geostationary orbit. It's on a 20, sorry, it's on a 12.5-hour cycle, which means it moves like along the orbit by, half an hour for every orbit. So over like a couple of weeks, it's gonna survey the entire geostationary belt, and it'll keep on doing this. Now, it's having to expend fuel to maintain this because the apogee, the argument of the perihelion will actually precess, but this is clearly an intended operation. It's a spacecraft which is surveying spacecraft up there for some reason. NASA has selected SpaceX to deliver laser communication capabilities for next year's Artemis III mission. NASA had asked for alternate communication capabilities because they wanted to get higher performance than what TDRS is capable of doing. And it really doesn't surprise anyone that they are partnering with SpaceX, who previously demonstrated laser link communication on the From-2 mission. They're going to have two of these laser communications modules which are going to be attached to the spacecraft. I presume this means they're going to be attached to the service module, which will burn up after flight. But there was another alternative that they could just like shine something out the window or whatever. But yeah, it sounds like they're going to be using laser communication from the module. And that will provide them like high resolution 4K video live from the Artemis II mission, which I am very much looking forward to. Speaking of really cool footage, we had the Psyche mission. They flew past Mars earlier, and they were, of course, using that to get a gravity assist, but they were also using it to test a lot of their instruments. And all the data that they've collected has been compiled into some really cool movies. They have this, high-resolution fly-past data where you can actually see the craters on the surface that they've been snapping with their camera. They were using their magnetometers, gamma ray, neutron spectrometers, basically, on one hand, calibrating the instruments, and on the other hand, verifying that they were seeing stuff that they expected and potentially seeing stuff that they had never seen. Regardless, there's a really cool movie of this as it, of course, gets kicked up into a higher orbit and will eventually reach the Psyche asteroid. So yeah, speaking of open source, while we're here, yeah, that was a great weekend for me and a whole bunch of other space nerds. I saw a lot of you out there, and I was really grateful for all the questions and comments. And yeah, I was really happy to take photos with you. I did three panels. I did, obviously saw Tim Dodd on a bunch of them, and I saw Brian McManus from Real Engineer, Insane Engineering, right? Interesting, on the space panel, we had a NASA astronaut, but what I found interesting was like Hank Green was the moderator, Tim Dodd was on there. Neither of them knew that they had asteroids named after them. So I was able to deliver this news to them. Very cool. But NASA Ames, they had a booth at Open Source, which was pretty cool. And one of the amazing things that they had, not they had moon rocks. I've seen a lot of moon rocks. No, the coolest thing that they had was they had slices from the Artemis 1 and 2 heat shield just like sitting out for people to look at closely. They had somebody there making sure you didn't touch or lick or whatever, right? But you could really see the difference between Artemis 1, where you had these big chunks coming, spallating off, and Artemis 2, where there was like none of this effect. So it was like a fantastic physical demonstration of the difference in the re-entry profile and how that affected the heat shield. And the next day, like after open source finished, me and a bunch of other people got a tour of NASA Ames, and I'm going to be showing you some video from that already. I already posted a short showing picking up the heat shield tile after it comes out of the oven at 2000 Celsius, glowing hot, but you're able to pick it up by their fingers. Many of us volunteered to do that. Unfortunately, we're told that NASA employees were you had to be a NASA employee to do it, which is probably why Matthew Dominic, who was an astronaut, got to do it. And a day after that, by the way, at NASA Ames, there was the Exploration Science Forum, and Victor Glover from Artemis 2 was there, and one of the interesting things that he said during like his Q&A bit was he was asked about, you know, plans for Artemis 4 and 5, and he was he seemed to say that, look, if we are in a race to get boots back on the moon, NASA should actually prioritize equatorial landings. Now, we're all talking about moon base, but the South Pole is a little less well known. It is the terrain is a lot more rugged. We have these large maria on the near side, which of course were visited back in the 60s. He thinks that it would make a lot of sense for NASA to prioritize one of these sites just to get familiar with the vehicles. But anyway, I thought that was interesting that he was basically in the same place almost at the same time, but I somehow missed him. Rocket Factory Ulzberg, they stacked their rocket in preparation for a test fire. There was a NOTAM published for a test firing July 26th at the Saxavord Spaceport in Shetland Islands. They showed us some pictures of the booster all assembled. And then just today they said, yeah, we're going to have to destack this. We found an issue. So at least they didn't find an issue during the static fire that resulted in an explosion. So yeah, they're working slowly towards getting this thing ready for flight. I have no idea what the nature of the problem is, but yeah, it was stacked and then destacked. Northrop Grumman, who I mentioned earlier in their satellite servicing vehicle, they had an earnings call which touched on the current status of Vulcan. They don't expect the GEM-63XL boosters to be in a working state before the end of the year. This means that ULA will not be able to return Vulcan to launch, at least with the solid rocket motors, until next year. Now, I believe there's some missions that they could do with a bare Vulcan, so we might actually see that fly, but yeah, this is not great. Northrop Grumman are also working on the HALO module, the habitation and logistics for the Gateway. Obviously, Gateway is dead, but they still have money from NASA to work on this. They're currently trying to address the corrosion issues in the pressure vessel, and they're looking to see how this can be repurposed for the new vision of the lunar base. Obviously, a pressure module is an important thing if you're going to have people on the moon, so we could well see this converted to a lander, which will be part of a permanent lunar installation of some sort. Boeing also had an earnings call, and they again confirmed that Starliner is taking a lot longer to get approved for its cargo flight than we expect. Now, Boeing seemed to think that they might be able to get a Starliner flying in a cargo mission before the end of the year. Last time NASA talked about it, they were talking about next year. But, you know, Boeing, of course, are trying to look good to their investors or customers or whatever, their stockholders. I think that's technically the word. I mean, Boeing also own 50% of ULA, so they are very much interested in having Starliner flying, and they're also very interested in having Vulcan flying. And it is interesting that they did try to sell Starliner, but apparently no one was interested in paying, and the people most likely to have use of Starliner, Blue Origin, were much more interested in building their own vehicles. So yeah, Starliner is going to remain a Boeing thing for this, you know, for now. It was also Oshkosh week last, by the way, Air Venture, where you have all the planes flying in. And there was, of course, all the usual cool stuff like biplanes with jet engines attached. But we had Jared Isaacman, NASA administrator, flying in. He was there in his MiG-29. He did a bit of a show on that. But he also was flying around F-5s with information with the other pilots. These are the ones that have the NASA-like payload for America 250. They were out flying information. What I found interesting was during one of the passes with the F-5 as they flew low, they set up the pyrotechnics on the runway. Like, there's these like big explosions, fireballs that they create when the military jets fly over, except that these F-5s are trainers, right? They're painted up for NASA. They're not really supposed to be military, right? They're not really supposed to be delivering, like, you know, bombs. However, I like to think of this as a tribute to NASA's DART mission, or the LCROSS missions, the one that smashed stuff into planetary bodies in the name of science. And so that I can get behind. Anyway, I wish I could have got to Oshkosh. It was just crazy. There was a lot of stuff going on there. But yeah, you know, just real world just gets in the way. Okay, over in Europe, they're having a big hot summer and there are wildfires all over the place now. This is a major problem. In Spain, the Madrid Deep Space Communications Complex was very much threatened by wildfires. This is only one of three sites in NASA's Deep Space Network that's used to provide 24/7 coverage. Like they need one in each, essentially each slice of the Earth, and that was the one that covered Europe. So yeah, fires got very close. They surrounded it, but a few days later, they've now moved on. Josef Aschbacher has confirmed that they went and they looked at the site. They tested all the hardware. They made sure everything's working, and it is actually returned to service with the Deep Space Network. But the fires, of course, continue. In the UK, on the other hand, they're wanting to save money, and they're going to shut down Jodrell Bank. Right, Jodrell Bank was like founded in 1945. It was the world's largest radio telescope for a long time. But now they're shutting down the funding, and so unless they can find an alternate source of funding, they're going to have to stop operations in 2028, which is kind of ridiculous, frankly. It's just part of a broader, set of cuts in astronomy and nuclear and particle physics, which are going to have impacts across the US, like across the UK. The James Clerk Maxwell telescope, that's one that was involved in the Event Horizon telescope, this millimeter wave observatory that's able to perform these microwave, not even microwave, these millimeter wave observations, which they could synchronize with other observations and get these close-up images of black holes. Well, so yeah, they're no longer going to be funding that. So this is like I don't know what's going on here. Like, come on, Britain, get your act together, right? Rocket Lab have secured a deal which is going to have them opening a launch site in Alaska. This is part of a deal with Space Force, so they're going to be able to perform 18 suborbital missions. So what's interesting is that they're going to be moving their HASTE missions up to Alaska, which I guess means there will be fewer people around to actually pay attention to what's going on. They're not going to be launching them off the Atlantic seaboard. They're going to be heading them, south into the Pacific. Yeah, that's an interesting one that they're getting a new launch site up there. That'll be, of course, in addition to their launch site in Wallops and in New Zealand. Blue Origin are continuing their cleanup. So the launch table is now being taken out. This was apparently as damaged by the explosion, but it looks fairly robust. They're bringing that out. They're going to refurbish that, and it should be outfitted with all the new umbilicals and stuff, and they'll be put back in place to sustain new launches. They have now destacked the entire access tower, so they're going to take that off and make the repairs. But also, while they're making these repairs, they're going to apply like all the new plumbing and connectors that are going to be needed to support the New Glenn in its new form, in its new position. Blue Origin have also reached a deal with NASA to take over the B2 test stand in Stennis, and they're going to use that to test the second stages of New Glenn. So this is a Space Act agreement. And yeah, this site in Stennis was built in the 1960s to test like the first stage of the Saturn V, and it was later used for the space shuttle and for Delta IV, and most recently it was a place where they did the green run tests of SLS, right? Where they actually put an entire booster there and they started it firing for its full duration. And yes, it proved that using old shuttle technology actually works. But yeah, Blue Origin's now taking this over and they're going to be firing their second stages from up there. Okay, so earlier in the month, a Pegasus XL launched the Lynx spacecraft built by Catalyst. This is designed to rendezvous with the Swift Observatory and reboost it. Well, after some work or after some time in orbit, they have encountered a problem with the attitude control system. So at this point, I'm told that two of the three reaction wheels are currently not operating, and there is some loss in operability or functionality in its cold gas thruster system. Now, it currently remains power positive. They are still able to operate, but they are trying to figure out how to despin this spacecraft, get it under control so they can start flying it again. Look, this was the first spacecraft by this company. It's not uncommon for first spacecraft to have problems which are not foreseen because it, lack of experience. We are still hoping this mission is going to sort itself out and become successful because, Swift has no other option at this point. We always knew this was a long shot, to be clear, But it would be great if it succeeds, right? Finally, just yesterday, a company called Hop Aero, a Y Combinator venture, came forward with an autonomous hypersonic cargo rocket that delivers about 550 kilograms, pounds, 250 kilograms of hardware up to 450 miles in 15 minutes. So this launches out of a standard 40-foot shipping container. It basically is supposed to fold up, launch, and land downrange wherever material is needed. Now, this isn't worldwide cargo delivery. This is a little more topical, a little more close at hand. This is a fascinating idea once again, and I'm going to say like 450 miles. You can cover that in a few hours. I'm not sure what benefit there is of reducing that to 15 minutes, but I'm sure somewhere in the US, Armed Forces logistics train, they're looking at some corner where they're like, if we could do something in 15 minutes within 500 miles, this is what we could do. And someone at Y Combinator has said, yeah, we're going to cover this little corner of the logistics chart. I find it fascinating. What I really find actually fascinating or funny is somebody posted this all these news articles saying Hop Aerospace is going to deliver cargo worldwide. Like 450 miles is not worldwide. I mean, it's worldwide if you're on Kerbin, but we're not on that planet. And so that is the end of the news. Things I'm looking forward to. First of all, we want to see whether SpaceX can actually pull it all together and get Starship 20 to Australia. It's got 600 miles to go or more. The seas may not want it to happen, but I think it's worth trying. But also, we know for sure that a Falcon 9 second stage is going to impact the moon on August 5th. This is an experiment, I guess. It's not an experiment. It's something that happened purely by accident. And I will no doubt be trying to point whatever telescopes I have at that to see if I see anything. It probably won't see anything, but you don't know unless you try. I'm Scott Manley. Fly safe.